Lean closer, my children. The nights are growing long. The snow deepens. And we have need of a mighty story to bundle us and carry us back to the light. But what manner of story should we hear? Perhaps Thor and Loki in the hall of the great giant Thymir, or of Hervor and the cursed sword Tyrfing. I know. Tonight I will tell you the saga of King Harald, the hard ruler. Brother to a saint, servant to an empress, death to a dragon.
Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, my scald.
Who is ready to hear a great tale of vengeance?
Hoo-hoo. I am. And we're coming at you this time, unfortunately, without our beloved Joe Mason for the third installation of our series about the Norman Conquest. Welcome back. We know you miss Joe. We miss him, too.
It doesn't feel the same without him.
It really sometimes... can still hear that hurdy-gurdy in the background. And we are super excited to get into this story because it is honestly maybe the most fun we'll have in a long time and for a long time. No, just kidding. We're really excited to get into this story. So over the past two episodes of this series, we talked about the formation of the English state and how this led to one man named Harald Godwinson sitting on the English throne. In 1066, where all of our plot lines are going to converge in this grand sort of confrontation. And so now it's time to switch tracks a little bit and move to another thread, which will also lead us to 1066. This is the story of another one of our big players, Harald Sigurdsson, or as he's known more often in the narrative, Harald Hardrada. Harald's the, what is it, the hard ruler.
Mm-hmm.
Harald the Severe, basically.
Yeah.
Although this was not a name that he was known by in his life.
No, everybody just decided retroactively that he was a dickhead.
Because he was Harald Fairhair in his life, wasn't he?
Yeah. No, he was. He got sort of retroactively fitted into the kind of... Nobody really knows where the hard ruler stuff comes from definitively. It certainly wasn't kind of something that he was referred to at the time. But... the salient point is that by 1066, he is the king of Norway and has designs on the English throne. But to understand why he is the king of Norway and why he thinks that he has a right to rule England despite being some guy from Norway, we need to take a long and circuitous journey across the length and breadth of Europe. Actually, and Asia as well. We go to Asia for a bit. Harald Sigurdsson is one of the most well-traveled people in all of the Middle Ages. And he also lived a life that was a sort of almost like cartoonishly Hollywood blockbuster.
It was rip-roaring. It was rollicking. It was.
And part of the reason for why it's so rip-roaring and rollicking and sort of narratively satisfying. Most of our information about Harald's life comes from... a collection of Norse sagas that were written down in Iceland several hundred years after his death. The two main ones that we're going to be engaging with are King Harald's saga, which is about the life of Harald Hardrada, and the saga of St. Olaf, who is the man who preceded Harald as the king of Norway, but has important sort of biographical information about Harald's early life.
Is Olaf Harald's brother, or am I dumb?
Half-brother, yeah. And when you are engaging with the sagas, it is very important to note, especially with these sagas, because there will be things in this that are very Tolkien-esque, that are not historical, and we are going to, I think, not when we get into these kind of details that are very magical and improbable, we are not going to kind of, I think, waste your time explaining that these events probably didn't actually happen, because they will be well signposted and easy to identify. But I think that the sagas of Harald's life are fairly well corroborated by more kind of reliable, more historical sources that are being produced at the time in the various kind of places that he ends up. And so it's useful to think about the sagas as a kind of embellishment of history rather than this kind of invented mythos. But that being said, one of the things that makes these sagas so compelling is that Harald Hardrada himself is an outrageous character.
Oh, he's amazing. He's. I really hope you guys fall in love with him as much as we love him, because we love this man a lot.
He's like, I was saying to Olivia before we started, he is, to me, he is like one-third Aragorn from Lord of the Rings, one-third Captain Fleshheart from Blackadder, and one-third Captain Jack Sparrow. And you will see over the course of this series why each of these characters kind of feel like they were spun out from his life. But before we talk about Harald himself, we need to pick up, I think, on a thread that we left dangling in the last two episodes, which is what the peoples of Britain experienced from the late 8th century to the early 11th century was fundamental changes in the way that Scandinavian societies interacted with them. So you went from peaceful trading in the kind of at the start of the 8th century to, from 793 onwards, this ever increasing and intensifying and escalating series of raids to finally in the 1010s, actual proper kind of invasions by people who call themselves kings. And that evolution tracks a really important evolution in the nature of Scandinavian society that's really important for understanding who Harald was and the world into which he was born. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time at the top just talking about how the modern-day nations of Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and how they were created in the first place. Because it is just as complex as the story of how England is created, but thankfully we know far less about it, so we're not going to do...
You don't want to know.
No, we're not going to do three whole episodes. We begin in media res, early 8th century Scandinavia. And I should say, by the way, that what we're about to talk about is based mainly on the archaeological record and mostly on things like how are people buried and how big their houses were. That's generally how you kind of assess social status in non-literary societies.
To clarify, big house, big burial equals rich.
Yes.
Small house, small burial, that's poor.
Thank you, Olivia. So, in the inland areas of Scandinavia, the political landscape appears to be very, very recognizable to Britain about 100-odd years previously, which is you have a patchwork of these small, incredibly tiny-scale manor lordships. So it's essentially exactly the same as every other part of Europe at this time, which is a local lord who gains his wealth from agriculture and the land. But the western coast of Scandinavia, especially like along the coast of Denmark and the coast of Norway, or what are now Denmark and Norway, you have a new class of elite emerging who historians call the Sea Kings. Now, king is probably dignifying this office way too much. These are essentially just local gang leaders who make their money by shaking down people for the control of the trade of luxury goods like furs and walrus ivory and whetstones. I know, whetstones are a luxury good, all right? They're important.
I mean, yeah, you got to keep your knife sharp.
Yeah.
How else will you intimidate people?
Or skin these walruses.
Walrus everywhere, and not a knife to skin.
It's sad. It's a sad, sad situation. So in the late 8th century, these sea kings appear to have become bolder and more expansionist, first by raiding settlements in the eastern Baltic, and then by finding out there are a much more lucrative set of targets in the larger, more densely populated west, so in Britain, Ireland, and northern Francia. Now, the Northmen, as they are sort of known in this period, were known to the people of Britain as traders, and through that trade, the Northmen would have been aware that these lands are absolutely chock-a-block with large houses full of gold, populated exclusively by people who cannot and will not fight.
Just dozens and dozens of Britain's nerdiest men.
Yeah. Conveniently located on isolated promontories.
Filled with gold.
Deliberately placed as far away from people who could potentially help them as possible.
Yep.
So these sea kings, again, these are like their sort of land-based equivalents. These guys are not big operations. They can't command large armies. And so these raiding parties, like the one that attacks Lindisfarne in 793, are quite small. But the thing about them is that they bring wealth back to their homelands, which only fuels more competition amongst the local elites. Basically, this money isn't just getting extracted from Britain, it's being invested into the local political system within these territories, which means, and more competition between the local lords for these new resources means more consolidation, because competitions have winners.
Yeah, and I think, like, it's, and Viking society, I think even at this point, is very competitive. All mm-hmm. societies, of course, are, but Viking society is very competitive, and it's very, very prestige-oriented. And one of the best things you can do to establish your security in Viking society is to make a name for yourself. And so being, you know, a successful hunter of fame and glory and wealth was extremely, extremely valuable social currency to these people.
Yeah, and so these raiding parties start to, over the, you know, the 9th century, start to get bigger and bigger and start to actually blossom into these full-on migratory communities of thousands of people, which include not just, you know, we think of the Viking raiders as these sort of the cast-offs of Scandinavian society, these young men who are kind of seeking their fortune. But in fact, these quote-unquote raiding parties could often include like thousands of people, including women and even children. Not that they were participating in the fighting, but it's like it was an almost nomadic kind of existence of traveling back and forth.
Well, you needed your wife there to mend your socks. And, yeah, you know, once she's there, yeah, there's going to be some kids. Yeah.
And you come back very excited from killing all those monks. You need to do something with all that energy.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, that's a sign. I think there's signs swinging back and forth outside.
That's fun.
It's actually kind of a nice sort of ASMR background.
I know, noise. It's very
one of those
medieval.
Hangy signs.
We're sitting on top of a tavern.
We are. Well, it used to be an all bar one. Oh, you know what? It's not actually a sign, it's a clock. Because the clock says all bar one on it. That's the only thing that keeps it from being very Sleepy Hollow, is that it is an all bar one
yeah.
clock.
Degentrification. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
So that means is that raiding and trading in the plunder of raiding within Scandinavia becomes an industrial scale activity. And by the way, that plunder is not just referring to gold and sort of and elaborate candlesticks they can melt down. This also means human beings. So this is a really important thing to understand about Viking society, is that this was a very much a slave society. Slaves were imported and sold all across Europe by Viking traders, both, you know, bringing them from the east to west and west to east. And there's a lot of money to be made in that. And so much as sort of we had the FA Cup of Nations within Britain at more or less this time, Scandinavian politics starts to consolidate to the point where there are maybe 15 kingdoms in modern-day Norway. in the mid-9th century and from like dozens and dozens and dozens before, and that number is continuing to drop precipitously. So there is, so Scandinavia is heading towards some kind of political unity, but we really don't have any sort of sense of that, what that process actually was, because these people did not write anything down.
No, they told lots of, they recited lots of poems.
None of which we know anything about.
Yep.
Because the only Scandinavian poems we have were written down by some Icelandic nerds 300 years later. Anyway, so according to the sagas and the legends, by the 870s, a man called Harald Fairhair, not to be confused with a different Harald Fairhair who we will meet later, had established himself as the overlord of Norway. And I'm using that term very, very broadly, or sorry, very, very deliberately, because nobody thinks that Harald Fairhair actually was the king of Norway in the way that we would think about, you know, Athelstan as the king of any kind of unified England. He was just the big boss. And the other reason why we're not sure about that is because we don't think he probably didn't exist,
Harald Fairhair. Yeah, all the contemporary scholarship is, all the sagas are like, you know, going on and on about Harald Fairhair. And yeah, the contemporary scholarship is that he simply did not exist, or he was maybe just like some guy who happened to live somewhere.
It's a classic time. It's a classic King Arthur situation where you're just pointing at any guy called Artorias and being like, that's him.
Yep.
But by the year 1000
sorry. I'm just trying to imagine them trying to, like, you know, identify like the real King Charles in like 3000 years by just pointing at different celebrities named Charles. Charles Darwin. Charles Dance definitely could happen.
Charles Dance, actually. Charles Dance even sounds like a, this was a common nickname for King Charles.
Because he loved to dance.
He's known as Charles the Dancer.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I can hear that.
He was known as Charles Darwin because he loved social Darwinism.
So by the year 1000, there is something called the Crown of Norway, and it is held by a guy called Olaf Tryggvason, who is the first kind of Norwegian king that we can sort of definitively say did exist. So by the year 1000, there is something called Norway, and it's led by Olaf Tryggvason. Denmark is even more of a headache. So our first evidence of substantive Danish kings comes in the early 9th century, but there are continual civil wars throughout that period. But we know that by the late 10th century, some kind of royal authority was well established in Denmark, because this guy called King Harald Bluetooth, and yes, I know this is a commonly known fact, but I do want to say it anyway because it's fun. This is the guy that Bluetooth is named after. King Harald Bluetooth was building these enormous monumental complexes at his capital in Jelling, which, and a network of fortresses along his southern border, which, given that that would have required an enormous amount of manpower and labor to produce, does suggest that he had some kind of strong political control over Danish territory. Sweden is even more complicated. We can't even get to Sweden.
It's all fine. And you know,
Sweden is a place that exists, but they're not, they will not figure significantly in this story.
And if you look up there now, like, it's not gotten much more clear what's going on. Still just a lot of big blonde guys going,
standing
bork,
on,
bork, bork.
Standing on bogs.
Yeah, exactly.
So much like in England, the political consolidation in Scandinavia coincides with the arrival of Christianity. So it's in this sort of nebulous, vague 9th century period where we start to see the first sustained efforts to convert the Vikings to the Christian faith. Now, as we talked about in the first episode of this series, the relationship between kings and the church is mutually beneficial. The church has administrative structures that can be helpful in kind of imposing any kind of logical order to your territory, and being blessed by God is a better legitimizing factor than, well, this is the guy with the biggest club.
Yep. Well, that was basically how it went in England.
Yeah, and of course, the other reason is that trade with the Christian world was an incredibly important part an incredibly important part of the Scandinavian economy, and so becoming Christian could be a very lucrative opportunity both for individual Vikings and for Scandinavian kings. So we know that both Olaf Tryggvason and Harald Bluetooth were very strong supporters of Christianity in their kingdoms and worked very hard to bring Christian influences into Scandinavian society. But there were plenty of holdouts across Scandinavian society, and we have a lot of evidence that the old beliefs of the Aesir and the sort of pre-Christian pagan faith coexisted with Christianity, both on a societal level and also possibly, and this is my absolute crank opinion, but also possibly within people's individual faiths. Polytheism is very flexible in a way that monotheism isn't. And actually saying, oh, behind these gods, there is another bigger god who is responsible for everything is very interesting. It's an interesting idea, and it kind of does fit with some stuff. That's some weird stuff in the sources that we do have. But anyway, one example of this cohabitation is that we know that in 10th century Trendgarden in Denmark, at least one smith was using the same soapstone mold to cast both crosses and Thor's hammers. And there are also lots of objects that archaeologists have called, quote-unquote, hammer crosses, which seem like they were deliberately ambiguous and could be interpreted different ways depending on how you wanted to see them.
Yeah, I read in an academic paper, I really, really, really wanted to find a source for this that was like a corroborating source, and I couldn't find the, you know, whatever primary source for it, but I read something that I really want to be true, which was a story of a Norse king like currying favor with a local church official by giving him silver like crosses and artifacts that he had plundered from a different church in Wales.
You people love this stuff.
Yep.
That's brilliant. So anyway, that's a quick primer on what does Scandinavian society look like at the turn of the millennium. It is a country of large, loose kingdoms where Christianity is gradually kind of taking hold and certainly has official sanction. And now we return to our plotline. Because in 986, King Harald Bluetooth of the Big Monumental Projects is overthrown by a guy who may or may not have been his son, nobody quite knows, welcome to Viking history, by the name of... you know this.
Oh, by Svein Forkbeard.
By Svein Forkbeard.
This is like such a beautiful thing about Viking history is every guy, it's either like he was either the king of Norway or he didn't exist.
Oh, there's more of that to come. So Svein Forkbeard was hugely ambitious, as we know from his exploits in England. But he also, before he even set his sights on England, he decided that he was going to try and conquer Norway. So in the year 1000, Svein led a large fleet of Danes, Swedes, and rebel Norwegians who ambushed Olaf Tryggvason when he was sailing home from a raid in Pomerania. And this was one of the greatest all-time Viking naval battles. It's incredibly... Go and read the saga of Olaf Tryggvason because it is... It's beyond Tolkien-esque. It's almost like 300. It's brilliant. And Olaf was vastly outnumbered, and so when all hope was lost, he threw himself into the water, either to die or escape. Either way, he's never heard from again, and the throne of Norway passes to Svein Forkbeard. With the control of Scandinavia secured, Svein was free to dream bigger to the very vulnerable target across the North Sea, called Ingerland. So anyway, the rest of Svein's Forkbeard story we know because we've already talked about it, and we know that he dies shortly after conquering England in 1014. So after Svein Forkbeard dies in 1014, mysteriously #vaxxed ? the crown of Norway passes to a man called Olaf Haraldsson. Now, Olaf Haraldsson was an enthusiastic supporter of Christianity. And he sort of he was very strong in promoting it among the periphery of Norway, which pissed off a lot of the outstanding kind of a lot of the outstanding pagan lords in Norway. And he made a lot of enemies quite quickly, I think, is the pertinent point. He was also very fond of his younger half-brother called Harald Sigurdsson. King Olaf's saga tells us of the following interaction between the two brothers, which is very clearly a transparent setup for what's going to happen in the sequel. The saga tells us that the king, brackets, that's Olaf, was walking with his mother about the farm, and they came to a playground where Asta's sons, Guthrum and Halfdan, were amusing themselves. They were building great houses and barns in their play, and were supposing them full of cattle and sheep. And close beside them, in a clay pool, Harald was busy with chips of wood, sailing them, in his sport, along the edge. The king asked him what these were, and he answered, "These were ships of war." The king laughed and said,
"Ha, ha, 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 the time may come, friend, when thou wilt command ships."
Huzzah!
Huzzah!
Then the king called to him Halfdan and Guthrum, and first he asked Guthrum,
"What would thou best like to have?"
"Cornland," replied he.
"And how great wouldst thou like thy cornland to be?"
I would have the whole nest that goes out into the lake sown with corn every summer. On that nest there are 10 farms."
The king replies,
"There would be a great deal of corn there. Huzzah!"
In case you couldn't tell, the huzzahs are us editorializing.
I don't know when or where we decided that Vikings say huzzah after every sentence.
Huzzahs are implied.
Oh, yeah.
There are a lot of lines in the sagas where huzzah is punctuation.
Yeah.
And turning to Halfdan, he asked,
"And what would thou like best to have?"
Let's see, what's Halfdan's voice? "Cows!" "No, cows," he replied.
"How many wouldst thou like to have?"
"When they went to the lake to be watered, I would have so many that they stood as tight round the lake as they could stand."
"That would be great housekeeping."
Such an underhanded compliment, or a backhanded compliment. Yeah,
you have no idea of the logistics involved in this, you child.
"And therein ye take after your father."
Then the king says to Harald,
"And what wouldst thou like best to have?"
"Hurstcarls."
"And how many wouldst thou have?"
"Oh, so many I would like to have as would eat up my brother Halfdan's cows at a single meal."
The king laughed, and said to Asta,
"Here, mother, thou art bringing up a king."
So very clearly, transparently setting up
something. Guess about which of these three became king? Hurstcarls in this case, by the way, are like soldiers, basically.
Yeah, it translates directly to house servants. It basically means like soldiers in the royal kind of household.
Yeah, it's the same origin of the name Carl, which is also the origin of the word churl, which essentially is a name that just meant like guy or dude.
House guys.
Yeah, it's like house guy. It's also house, the surname.
House blokes.
House lads. House geezers. But it's also the origin of the name Charles, which is quite funny.
So while Olaf and Harald are having great japes over in Norway, Canute is busy taking over and then ruling England. Now, in 1028, Canute decided,
"Wouldn't it be splendid if I ruled England and Denmark and also Norway? Huzzah!"
So according to King Olaf's saga, he sent an ultimatum to King Olaf.
"King Canute considers all Norway as his property, and insists that his forefathers before him have possessed that kingdom, but as King Canute offers peace to all countries, he will also offer peace to all here, if it can be so settled, and will not invade Norway with his army, if it can be avoided. Now if King Olaf Haraldsson wishes to remain king of Norway, he will come to King Canute and receive his kingdom as a fief from him, become his vassal, and pay the scat which the earls before him formerly paid.
The scat is just like the taxes, basically. He's like, pay your taxes, buddy, and nothing, nobody will get hurt.
I love the,
if it can be avoided.
Yep, no, exactly.
It's so backhand. But Olaf has a brilliant response. Again, remember, this is being ventriloquized 300 years later. But let's just enjoy the story for what it is. Know that the basics of this happened, but we're having some fun. So Olaf responds,
I have heard say, by old stories, that the Danish king Gorm was considered but a small king of a few people, for he ruled over Denmark alone. But the kings who succeeded him thought that was too little. It has since come so far that King Canute rules over Denmark and England and has conquered for himself a great part of Scotland. Now he claims also my paternal heritage, and he will then show some moderation in his covetousness. Does he wish to rule over all the countries of the north? Will he eat up all the kale in England? He shall do so, and reduce that country to a desert, before I lay my head in his hands or show him any other kind of vassalage. Now you shall tell him these my words. I will defend Norway with battle axe and sword as long as life is given to me, and will pay scat to no man for my kingdom.
Does anybody want to guess what Olaf does immediately when Canute invades Norway in response to this?
He runs away.
He leaves.
He's like, oops.
Oh no.
Called my bluff.
Psych. But within 2 years, Olaf is back at the head of a 3,600-man army of loyal Northmen and Swedes, back to face down Canute and win back his kingdom.
Woohoo! And so, by the, you know, narrative property. Surely.
Surely Olaf is the protagonist of this story. So according to Snorri Sturluson, oh yeah, by the way, he's the one writing all this down. You may remember him from previous episodes.
Actually, sorry.
So according to Snorri Sturluson, Olaf faced down Canute's army at the Battle of Stiklestad, where they were vastly outnumbered by an enormous army of peasants. And at Stiklestad, Olaf was joined by his young brother Harald, who is now a strapping 15-year-old. And according to Olaf's saga, the two had the following exchange.
It appears to me advisable that Harald, my brother, should not be in the battle, for he is still in the years of childhood only.
Harald replies,
certainly, certainly. Certainly I shall be in the battle, for I am not so weak that I cannot handle the sword.
And then he also composes some poetry before the battle, which will become a running theme.
My mother's eye shall joy to see a battered, blood-stained shield from me.
I think it's also worth, I just want to actually mention how much I love Norse sort of verse and verse culture and yes. Verse tradition. Because we have pretty well attested evidence that it was seen as an extremely honorable skill to have in Norse society to just be able to like compose poetry off the cuff, like,
yes.
You know, following the sort of Norse like metrical forms and traditions. And sometimes, of course, the poetry that people would recite or compose was like long-standing pieces of work that were passed down through the oral tradition, but there was also, you know, seen as quite like, but it was also seen as very prestigious to be able to just deliver poetry sort of extempore.
Check this shit out.
Exactly. And because, again, this was such a kind of fame-seeking and fame-centric culture, it was seen as like, you know, in a moment of particular sort of, you know, bravery or even at the moment of one's own death, if one is like looking down one's death with particular bravery, it would be seen as like extremely, extremely chic, basically, to deliver like a banger verse.
So Harald's story will feature ample poetry composed ostensibly by him.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we don't know who composed all of this poetry because it was written down much after the fact, but it is, you know, these, he is being preserved by the saga writers as a good poet.
Yes. It is a value of a good king and a good leader to be able to do that.
Yeah. I actually read a paper. Sorry, this is a bit of a tangent, but you know, I love a tangent.
Yeah.
I actually read a paper. It was specifically about Iceland and Icelandic poetry writing, but it was saying that essentially when people delivered a piece of impromptu poetry, they were hoping that it would catch on and other people would recite it in similar moments. So it was basically the people that make like TikToks hoping for like the audio to be used as like a sound. Or people who are like trying to make reaction images, except yes. It was like just little snippets of verse.
Oh, amazing. So Olaf stands at the head of his army, killing just so many Swedish people, until he comes face to face with one of Canute's champions, Thorir the Hound. Now, Thorir the Hound is a walk-on role in this story, but he's also one of my all-time favorite guys. So he's a Norwegian chieftain and a devout pagan who had sworn a blood oath to kill Olaf just because he was too good at being Christian. So he wore no armor. Instead, he wore a coat of reindeer hides that had been enchanted by mystical Sami shamans in the far north of Scandinavia to be impenetrable. So Olaf fights Thorir, one-on-one, and he manages to cut Thorir in the hand, but Thorir drives his spear under Olaf's chainmail and into his belly before another warrior strikes the death blow. And that is the end of King Olaf of Norway. And with Olaf dead, the battle turns into a rout. Harald flees the battle, wounded, lightly, and according to the sagas, found refuge with a peasant who concealed and healed him. And Snorri says that when Harald was recovering, he composed the following guest verse.
My wounds were bleeding as I rode, and down the Bondis strode, killing the wounded with the sword. The followers of their rightful lord. From wood to wood I crept along, unnoticed by the Bond throng. Who knows, I thought, a day may come, my name will yet be great at home.
I went, wow, foreshadowing. It's not subtle. So, after recovering, Harald meets up with some of the other survivors of Olaf's army, and they procure some ships and begin to sail east. Now here we have to take another step back and talk a little bit about what has been happening in Eastern Europe and what the Vikings have been doing in Eastern Europe from the 8th century onwards. So Vikings, at pretty much the same point at which the Vikings start attacking first the Baltic and then Western Europe, Vikings also have been pushing east, expanding their trading networks inland from the Baltic, through this network of huge navigable rivers that Eastern and Central Europe is famous for. Things like the Rhine, Dnieper, the Don, the Volga. And Vikings are also have the perfect technology for this, because Viking boats are designed to be very light and flat-bottomed, which means that they are very good at traveling over rivers, and they're also very easy to portage, which is the fancy word for you pick up a boat and carry it for a bit.
No, men, it's not carrying your boat, it's portage!
Now, Eastern Europe at this point is mostly just forests filled with Turkic and Slavic people hitting each other over the head with big sticks.
And bears.
And they're, yes.
And
they're,
bison. Yeah, Although they're all not very indistinguishable from each other. Cut that out.
No, we're not staying in. So the Vikings aren't looking to trade with the bears. They're trying to get through Eastern Europe because they know if they can build a trading network, then they can strike it fantastically rich. Because these rivers, when they feed down into the Black Sea, they provide an incredible route to the two great metropolises of the medieval Eurasian world, which are Constantinople and Baghdad. But in order to kind of facilitate that trade, the Vikings built this vast network of trading settlements where Vikings could rest and trade with local people. So again, these Slavs or sort of various kinds of Turks. It's a really interesting period, and it's a really interesting place that we don't know an awful lot about, because again, none of these people are writing very much of anything down. And it is the Wild West, right? And perhaps the most important of these settlements is Larraga, which is a small town that's a few miles inland of Lake Larraga at the mouth of the Volkhov River. Now, this was the gateway to this wild east, but it was also a muddy and chaotic place. Now, the historian Neil Price has an absolutely amazing description of Larraga in the early medieval period. And yes, I know The Rest is History read a bit of this description on their podcast, but I wrote this down in my notes first, and I'm going to read more of it. That's so please right. Do not think that I have the greatest of respect for those men, but I am not copying them.
And anyways, if you do listen to their podcast, what are you doing? Listen to our podcast.
Why do you need to know about history that's not medieval? What's wrong with you?
Exactly. It's all medieval.
What do you want to do? Read the, listen to the two guys who've written about 50 books between them? So Neil Price has this amazing description. Think of a muddy, riverine deadwood with greater ethnic diversity and a multitude of gods, and it's probably not so far from the truth. The East was somewhere to make a new start, to shape a different life, and perhaps to forget a previous one. These endeavors should not be seen solely in terms of success. Imagine all the hopeful Scandinavian rubes, eager to build a future on the eastern rivers, welcomed with open arms by the sharp-faced hustlers of Larraga. Need supplies? Step over here. Thirsty? Of course, shipmate. No funds? Well, luck is always capricious, but fortunately we have credit, and on such generous terms. The Larrigans are your newfound friends. A slap on the back, a horn of ale, and suddenly three more on the table. So generous! But their eyes never smile. You shake on the deal, and then that big Slav moves to block the doorway. There was probably nowhere easier for someone to disappear, willingly or not, and there would have been a lot of unmarked graves.
Oof.
And this is the world that the teenaged Harald Sigurdsson would have found himself in. Now, Larraga was a little bit more upmarket by the time he got there. Neil Price is mostly talking about a century before, but when I say upmarket, I mean they built some wall.
They had a Gales. They had a Starbucks and a Chipotle.
It had been lightly gentrified.
There was like graffiti, like, you know, rent caps now.
Yeah, exactly.
Larraga communities are being priced out.
So the world, and that speaks to the fact that the world of the East was not quite the untamed frontier it had been a few centuries ago, because the trade route down through the Volga was now under the control of an emerging power whose influence stretched from the Black Sea to the Arctic. And yeah. That kingdom's name was Kievan Rus.
And I think at least, you know, the benefit here is like, it's like a well-established, it's like the Scandinavian gap year, essentially, mm-hmm. isn't it? To like go east.
Yeah, it's like Australians in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, no, exactly. So it's not quite such a sort of, you know, trailblazing thing, but no. It is like extremely sort of well-established.
It's well-established, but also like, this is still a bit sketchy.
Well, yeah, it's like going to Southeast Asia. Yeah. You know, 20% of people lose their passports and get, you know, shaken down. Yeah. But, what you gonna do?
So we're now gonna talk about the origins of the Kievan Rus, which I should say as a health warning is at the moment one of the most politicized things in the Middle Ages, because it's kind of the pretext for the entire Russian invasion of Ukraine. So in addition to the fact that the origins of Kiev and the Kievan Rus are enormously politicized, they're also quite difficult to unpick on their own terms, so we're going to keep this very general. So according to the most broadly accepted narrative, the Finnic and Slavic tribes living east of the Black Sea at some point in the 9th century decided to stop paying tribute to their local Vikings and banished them. However, after banishing the Vikings, they were like, well, who's going to rule us now? And started bickering amongst themselves. So they resorted to inviting a Viking chieftain back to rule them as prince. this Viking chief was called Rurik. And Rurik was one of a group of people that are nebulously called the Rus. Now, Rus probably translates to the people who row.
In Sweden, I think, and maybe several other Scandinavian countries, Russia is still known as, like, rowing land.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's, I mean, Rus is the origin for Russia. It's the origin for Belarus. And, of course, in its time, Kiev and Rus will give birth to the modern state of Ukraine. But we are so far from that. So, according to the Russian Primary Chronicle, Rurik made his capital in Novgorod, which is a city in modern-day Western Russia. But when Rurik died and power passed to his relative Oleg, expanded the Rus power south, including conquering the trading town of Kiev in 880. Now, Kiev was built basically in this incredibly strategic point on the sloping western bank of Dnieper, of the river Dnieper, which is a crucial waypoint on the way to the Black Sea. And so, naturally, Oleg thought, well, this is actually a great place for our capital, and moved it there in the 9th century. Now, the Kievan Rus' estate was really a little more than a sort of loose collection of principalities and trading towns who owed some sort of vague fealty to Kiev and to the Grand Prince who ruled there. But it was a dynamic and expanding state, and by the 970s, it had nominal control of pretty much all the trade going from Scandinavia down the Volga. Now, Rurik and all of his subjects had all been various kinds of pagan, but by the turn of the millennium, Prince Vladimir the Great was baptized, probably to cement an alliance with a Christian kingdom to his immediate south, who we will come to promptly, and ordered the population of Kiev to become Christian as well. Now, in the early 11th century, Kiev was at the height of its power. It was a large, wealthy, fortified city with tens of thousands of people, ruled by a prince called Yaroslav the Wise. So it was at the court of Yaroslav the Wise that the teenage Harold and his companions arrived after presumably a pretty mosquito-bitten and arduous journey south. Now, according to Snorri Sturluson, Yaroslav warmly received Harald as Olaf's brother and made Harald a captain in his army. Again, teenager. Harald traveled basically across the territory of the Rus, possibly fighting against a range of nebulous enemies who might have included the Poles, the Pechenegs, and the Roman/Byzantines. Now, at some point, and this is where we get into slightly hashtag problematic territory. Now, Yaroslav had a daughter called Elisif, who King Harald's saga says he fell in love with immediately. The problem with that is that Elisif was a fucking child, like not even a teenager. It's probably more accurate that he was like, I should probably marry this guy's daughter so that I can get a dowry and I can spend that money on retaking my kingdom one day. But the problem is, Harald was still a lowly mercenary, essentially. And Elisif was, again, a child. So there are so many things standing in the way of that. So Harald spends a few years fighting in the army of Yaroslav until he decides to set sail once again with some of these companions to go further south into the Black Sea and join the Varangian Guard. And this is where I get very, very excited. Because it's time to go back.
Yeah.
It's been almost 2 years. It's time to go back to Constantinople.
Oh, she's been calling us back the whole time.
Oh!
When we last talked about Constantinople substantively in this podcast, she was a, I would say the phrase I would use is moldering skeleton of herself. She was, you know, the ruler of an empire that consisted of essentially a few miles around her perimeter. And she was a far cry from the great city of Constantine. Put all of those images out of your mind now, because we are going to be rev-turning to a very, very, very different city. So, potted history time of the early medieval Eastern Mediterranean. So, when the Roman Empire in the West disintegrated in the 5th century, the eastern half of the empire, which was by far the more populous and richer part of the empire, survived. However, in the 7th century, she suffered enormous invasions and massive conflict with the new rising power of the Arab caliphates. And by the 7th, and from the 7th century to the 11th, the Roman Empire, the surviving eastern half of the Roman Empire, had lost 2/3 of her territory, including enormous cities like Antioch and Damascus, and the vast wealth of Egypt, which had always been the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. And Constantinople was besieged 5 times in 50 years. Now, the effects that this had on Roman society were incredibly profound. So literary production, measured by things like, just the number of parchments, or just the number of books that are being copied. Because remember, you have to, for a book to survive, you have to copy it. Parchment has a pretty good shelf life, but it's not forever. So parchment became vastly more expensive, and so writing essentially collapsed. And this Roman society goes through this period, this series, actually, of sort of state-endorsed manias for iconoclasm, which destroyed almost every single icon in Constantinople, which obviously, if you know anything about Greek Orthodoxy now, is almost incomprehensible. Roman politics also becomes much more militarized and much more autocratic. The great wealth and the artistic accomplishment that sustained Constantinople as a global megacity, which is what it was in the early medieval and classical period, was gone. And it essentially becomes this sort of dour garrison town on the edge of Christendom, which is focused on surviving rather than in any meaningful way thriving. However, the empire has a series of significant military victories in the 9th century that brought some much-needed political stability and a flush of cash into the treasury. Now, this combines with important fiscal reforms and some already existing intellectual revival in the empire, which paved the way for a second golden age for Constantinople of wealth and artistic patronage and scholarship, known as the Macedonian Renaissance, after the Macedonian dynasty who oversaw it. This is the city that Harald Hardrada arrives at sometime in the 1030s. Now, according to Snorri Sturluson, the Skjald Bolverk describes Harald's arrival in the city.
Before the cold sea-curling blast, the cutter from the land flew past, her black yards swinging to and fro, her shields hung gunwale, dipping low. The king saw glancing o'er the bow Constantinople's metal glow. From tower roof and painted sails, gliding past towns and wooded vales.
So according to Snorri, when they arrive, Harald immediately presents himself to the royal court and offers his services directly to the real power in Constantinople at the time, which is the Empress Zoe. And now we have to talk about
Umama.
Umama is right and wrong.
Yeah.
Now we have to talk about one of my favorite characters in all of medieval history. So, Zoe and her younger sister Theodora were the kind of the last of the line of the last of the House of Macedon, which had been ruling Constantinople and overseeing the Roman Empire's sort of renaissance.
Do you know her epithet, by the way?
I actually don't.
It's Zoe Porphyrogenita.
Oh yeah, doesn't that just mean like of the purple?
Yeah, it means like born into the purple.
Yes, and she is the the reason for that is that she is the daughter of the Emperor Constantine the VII. And on his deathbed, Constantine forced his chosen successor called Romanos Argyros to divorce his existing wife and marry Zoe. Which I think is a dick move.
It's how it went back in the day.
This is very, I will say, over the course of this next section, we're going to hear about a lot of dynamics are very, like, it's all
a little
very
problematic.
It's very problematic. It also does make me feel like I'm listening to an episode of Stavi's World, and not just because everybody's Greek. Anyway, so Zoe was desperate to continue her father's line and immediately tried to make that happen for her. And she employed the use of numerous magical charms, potions, and amulets, along with, of course, copious amounts of sexual activity. Despite all this, the couple failed to conceive. And
I think there's a quite a plausible explanation for why that she doesn't get pregnant, right? That I think is quite a salient detail.
I mean, yes, there is.
Which is that, how old is she?
She's in her, like, 50s.
In her 50s. She's trying her hardest. And, you know, it's happened before.
Lots of people have fertility issues, you know? Like being 50.
Being 50 is a pretty...
You cannot get over being 50 with an amulet. Many have tried. So this clearly drove them apart because they stopped sharing a marital bed and stopped speaking to each other. So of course what happens next is that she starts having an affair with one of her servants called Michael. Now Michael had been very strategically placed, shall we say, by his brother John, who is like the chief court eunuch of the Roman court,
the scheming eunuch.
Hey, look at this local hunk. Yeah. Don't you want him?
And she allegedly is like quite a looker.
So the word that I have heard used is voluptuous. She's a MILF.
Yeah.
I mean, minus the M part, but she is, you should imagine a total Greek MILF. Just pause to picture that.
A total Greek MILF whose husband won't have sex with her despite the fact that she's like desperate to.
So she has to start preying on a younger man.
Yep.
I've had a lot of dreams like that. So anyway, so in 1034, Romanos falls ill, and rumors start to spread that Zoe was planning to kill him. So of course, for anybody who's watching The Traitors at the moment, what you've got to do, if people start suspecting that you're going to kill somebody, the one thing you have to do is not kill them. But of course, lo and behold, he dies on the 11th of April, 1034, and Zoe and Michael get married on the same day.
Yes! They had, like, all of the catering planned. Like, the food was already made. The invitations had been sent.
Look, Joe's not here, so I have to say it. Vaxxed. So, that's the absolute viper's nest that of imperial intrigue that Harold arrives into. Now, Harold joins the Varangian Guard, which, for anybody who hasn't sort of been following this podcast since the beginning, is the royal bodyguard of the Roman emperors in the sort of early to mid-medieval periods, which is comprised at this point primarily of Scandinavians who have sort of made this journey. Or, you know, people who've just grown up in Kievan Rus. And he starts traveling all over the Empire's frontiers to fight numerous enemies. So first he goes off to fight pirates in the Mediterranean and the Aegean Seas. And then he goes to Mesopotamia to fight some Arabs, as you do. And within a few years, Snorri claims that Harold was captain of the Varangian Guard. So after returning from the Middle East, Harold gets sent westwards to Italy. Now we have to backtrack once again. and talk about Italy in this period. So, southern Italy was mostly ... ruled by the Romans, but the north was controlled by the Holy Roman Emperor / the Pope. It's complicated. We have an episode about it. And Sicily was ruled by a Muslim caliphate. And so in 1038, the Romans send an army to reconquer Sicily, augmented by a band of 800 Norman mercenaries. I wonder if that is foreshadowing anything.
Woohoo!
So Harold joins this army and participates in a number of sieges of key cities, which successfully brought most of the island under Roman control again by 1040, including the island's capital of Syracuse. Now, the saga of Harald Hardrada relates pretty much all of these successes in detail, and I will say there is a part of the saga that becomes slightly interminable when it's just, the headings are literally, Harald takes a castle, Harald takes another castle, Harald takes a third castle.
Well, you know, it was oral tradition, like, everything had to be super repetitive so you could memorize it, so.
Yeah.
And, you know, it might seem boring to read is what I'm saying, but just imagine how thrilling it would have been to sit around a campfire and hear a guy be like, and then they another came castle. To another castle.
So, like, wow. I said that it's dull, but there are a few that are kind of singled out for sort of special treatment. So at one of these unnamed castles, the Byzantine army are camped outside, getting ready to besiege it, and they realize pretty quickly the castle's impregnable. So Harold is
like Zoe.
Just like...
Sorry, bad
just
taste.
Like, yeah, just like Zoe. So who have we offended so far? We've offended the community of people born without bones. You've offended people who can't get pregnant because they're in their 50s. Who else are you going to knock off?
The Jutes. Jewish community.
They don't know. That's not a reference to anything people have heard yet, Olivia. No,
you're right.
No, that's good. We're keeping that in. There'll be a bonus where we're going to understand Olivia's complicated...
People who twiddle their knobs.
All right, nothing wrong with that. Anyway, so Harold... and his Varangians sort of sidle up to the gates of the city, and he's like, huzzah! Hello there, friendly Italian Arabs! And announced to the city's defenders that their leader had died, and asked the city's Christian community to allow him a Christian funeral. And for reasons known only to them, they agreed to this. I guess because, you know, if you're Christians, you're like...
They want his ass to go to heaven.
Yeah.
Or at least purgatory for not that long.
Yeah. So... The Varangians sort of carry the coffin of their supposedly dead leader into the city. And once they had crossed the threshold, one of the coffin bearers fixed a bar in the gates and sounded a trumpet to signal the rest of the army to charge in. So the Varangians then rush into the city, slaughtering the priests and lay people indiscriminately and pillaging all the city's treasure and taking the city through, you know, very honorable Christian methods.
Does the leader pop out of the coffin with his sword?
I mean, it's implied.
Yeah.
So it seems like Sicily is about to be fully reconquered by the Romans. It's all going great. Harold has taken so many castles. It's terrific. However, in true late Roman fashion, at the moment of seeming triumph, just the most bizarre and interminable politics wins out. So suddenly there is a power struggle between the two commanders of the Roman army, leading the guy who has just been successfully leading the conquest to get fired and get sent back to Constantinople. And of course, the Muslims then immediately reverse all of the Romans' gains. Now, in any case, Harold has left. He just leaves for reasons that are not fully clear, possibly because he's like, I'm not staying for this. This is embarrassing.
Yeah.
But anyway, by this point, he is fabulously wealthy. Because, again, he's been pillaging all these towns and killing all these people. So he's got a lot of gold. He's got a lot of money. But he's also been sending a lot of this treasure back to Yaroslav in Kiev. It's just being like, hey, remember me?
Oh, classy immigrants. Always sending money back home to their families.
Well, it's basically being like, hey, remember me? I'm cooler now than I was when I left.
Yep. Oh, he's such a pimp. Well, just being in the Varangian Guard was quite prestigious.
Mm.
It was a great opportunity to plunder. I mean, I think, would it be unfair to say it was the medieval equivalent of being like a Navy SEAL?
Oh, yeah.
Because it was extremely prestigious, you know. Normally, of course, the medieval, like, wisdom is don't rely on mercenaries, but these guys are just known for being hard as shit, basically.
Well, the thing, to take a quick diversion into Varangian politics, I mean, Roman politics was so famously prone to factionalism and backbiting that actually having an honor guard of purely mercenaries who are only there because you're paying them can actually be more reliable than a guy who might potentially have it out for you for just stupid domestic politics reasons.
Yep.
So he returns to Constantinople. Again, these timelines are getting nebulous, but also Snorri does not provide us a great timeline. So he returns to Constantinople and is almost immediately sent back out, this time going east to Palestine. Now, Snorri claims that he then conquers the province of Palestine for the Romans, but there is basically no evidence that this happened. There is a... This does coincide, though, this story, with a sort of, essentially a peace treaty between the local caliph and the Roman emperor. So it does make a lot of sense that Harold might have been sent there essentially as part of a diplomatic party. It was a big deal. They were going to let them rebuild a big church in Jerusalem, basically.
It's kind of amazing. Like, imagine being a Viking in Jerusalem.
Well, exactly. You're just like, look at all these Jewish people.
Yeah.
I didn't know they made hats like this.
I mean, you have to imagine, even as like a Viking as well, you would have had some awareness of like the weight of history bearing down upon you.
Well, you're a Christian.
Also the Jews. Also the Jews were there. Yeah, I'm sure that was real interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing about Harold is that he's a Christian.
Yeah.
And so he'd be like, that's where Jesus was.
Mm-hmm.
This is sick. I mean, he visits Jerusalem and he bathes in the Jordan River, which is a very, like, you know, that's a good Christian thing to do.
Yeah.
So he's off having a jolly in Palestine, eating presumably a lot of dates and drinking just liters of olive oil.
Huzzah! Huzzah! I like it here. Oil, pour more oil on my body.
Jarl Olaf, I bet you can't drink as much olive oil as I can. Huzzah!
Olaf, I don't feel so good. Huzzah!
So meanwhile, more politics is happening. So Zoe and Michael, remember her hunk servant, had fallen out and Michael had banished her from his court. Now, Michael dies in 1041, and the next emperor is crowned, who is also called Michael.
Yep.
Who is the nephew of the first Michael. This Michael the Fifth, banishes Zoe to a nunnery on the island of Principe. But the announcement of this is enormously controversial within Constantinople. They did not want people fucking with their favorite MILF. Which is very relatable. And so, as the city descends into anarchy, Michael attempts to flee to a monastery, but he is found, arrested, blinded, and banished to a different monastery, this time permanently. And according to Snorri, the man who blinds Michael the Fifth after his very short-lived reign is, in fact, Harald Hardrada. Now, how does this work with the timeline of him being in Palestine? Don't worry about
it. Don't question it.
Don't worry about it. Snorri certainly isn't thinking about it. So Zoe is reinstated as empress, and this time she's ruling with one of her old flames, who is named, in the grand tradition of Roman emperors, is named Constantine. She's also ruling as co-empress with her sister Theodora, who we do not have time to get into. The only pertinent thing to mention about Theodora is that Zoe fucking hated her.
Yeah. Yep.
My younger and presumably more fertile sister. Look, it's a trap. It's a trap a lot of women fall into. It's sad when it happens, you know? Don't want to pit two bad bitches against each other.
I know. She is quite funny. She doesn't want to actually be the empress, does she? I think
she just wants to get laid.
No, I mean Theodora.
Oh, yeah.
Theodora also does not want to be empress. No. I think they literally drag her, because she's, like, living in an abbey or something.
She was quite happy as a nun.
She was a nun, and they go and they're like, do you want to be empress? And she's like, no, I'm a nun. And they're like, oh, you're empress.
I have to live with my idiot sister.
Yeah.
And her succession of terrible boyfriends.
Yeah. Hey, Stabby. So, I was born into a pretty privileged family, right? And, you know, whatever, like, I appreciate it, I respect it, like, you know. And my older sister, she's always been a little bit crazy. I always think she was my parents' favorite, you know, she, like, went off to school, she got married really young. And, you know, my parents put her in charge of, like, a lot of the family's business, because I don't know, they like her. But the thing is, like, she has, like, really, really bad taste in men. And she's always bringing home these, like, chuds. And, like, they don't give a shit about her. You know, I'm sure they like her money. Oh, they like her money. I think she lets their attention go to her head a little bit. But as soon as she gets rid of one, there's another one. Because she's got these massive bazonka honkers. And anyways, she's on her, like, third or fourth one of these guys. Or maybe it's her fifth. And, like... okay, it's all becoming pretty clear that it's not really working out. The company business is, like, failing, basically. And I'm supposed to go back and help sort her shit out. So she wants me to move in with her. And now she's gotten back together with her ex, Constantine. Who I'm not gonna lie, he's not that much better. And now they want me to move back in with them and run the family business. So what should I do? On one hand, it seems like a bad idea, but on the other hand, I don't really want to let the family legacy down. And, you know, maybe it would be fun.
Interesting. And by the way, speaking of dating, according to Snorri, at this point, Harald starts courting a Byzantine princess called Maria, who presumably did exist, I think. She seems to be attested to. Whether or not they actually were dating, anyway, so that sordid world of relationship disaster aside, let's return briefly to Norway. So while Harald was gone, cavorting and stealing and killing priests, politics in Norway moved on without him. So Knut, as we know, died in 1035 and was succeeded as king of Norway by a king called Magnus the Good. Magnus was an illegitimate son of Olaf, and this whole episode was received very poorly by the rest of Knut's family. We're like, well, who's this dickhead? I thought we got rid of these people. So in 1040, Harth the Knut starts preparing for an invasion of Norway to sort of bring Norway back within the still kind of extant North Sea Empire. However, a group of Norwegian and Danish noblemen convince Magnus and Harth Knut to reach a peace agreement. And the terms of the peace agreement that they reach are incredibly important. So under this agreement, the two would be one another's heirs if they died first. So if Magnus died first, then Harth Knut would inherit the kingdom of Norway. And if Harth Knut died first, then... Magnus would inherit Denmark. This agreement was not extended to the throne of England at the time, but later Norwegian leaders would claim that it did. So when Harald receives word of Magnus's ascension in 1042, he immediately petitions Zoe to allow him to return home, which she refuses. And Snorri has a wonderfully bitchy summary of why this was refused. He says,
When the Empress Zoe heard of this, she became angry and raised an accusation against Harold that he had misapplied the property of the Greek emperor which he had received in the campaigns in which he was commander of the army. The Varangians, who were then in pay in Constantinople, have told here in the north that there went a report among well-informed people that the Empress Zoe herself wanted Harold for her husband, and that she chiefly blamed Harold for his determination to leave Constantinople.
Although another reason was given to the public.
On this account, the Greek emperor had Harold made prisoner and carried to prison. Which, by the way, the subtext of that is so wonderful.
Yeah.
Which is, Zoe was angling to cuck Constantine. And when he ostensibly refused, he was like, husband, put this man who I've been trying to get to fuck me in prison for not fucking me.
Guards, seize this man.
Guards, seize this hunk.
He has not even looked once at my heaving bosom.
My prodigious heaving bosoms. So as Harold is being carried away to prison, Snorri claims that he has a vision of Olaf, who says, don't worry, little bro, hang on, let me do this. Don't worry, little bro, I've got you, just hang tight. Now, despite this, you know, ghostly apparition, Harold and his followers are stripped, searched, and locked in prison, surrounded by the bones of previously imprisoned prisoners. Ooh. And they come face to face with a great worm. So essentially, depending on how you translate it, this means big snake or dragon. And so there are a couple of versions of this story that I could read from. I'm going to read from Saxo Grammaticus's version. As soon as the dragon had slithered in, it rushed with immense voracity on the prey before. But Harold took a flying leap and landed on its back. Next, he plunged a barber's razor, which he had chanced to have concealed on his person.
Gotta cut my hair.
I love that he seemingly had the, like, Captain Jack Harkness approach of hiding weapons in his, well, you know.
Yeah.
Which he had chanced to have concealed on his person into the reptile's navel.
He stabs it in the belly button.
Yes. Because it was the only part penetrable by steel.
Yeah.
So the serpent writhes and rages, but can't reach Harold on its back. Meanwhile, one of Harold's companions takes a bunch of bones, puts them in a bag, and just starts swinging it at the snake. Until it dies. And then they're just sort of left there with this dead serpent for a while. And then so later that night, a distinguished lady of Constantinople comes to their door and says, listen, I was helped long ago by your brother King Olaf, so I will help you escape. And so she lets them out, and they have to race against time to escape the city and escape before the guards and presumably the Empress figure out that they're gone. So the escaping Viking...
Guards, bring that man back so he can look at my bosoms.
And make sweet, passionate love to me.
Yes.
So the escaping... Oh, by the way, at this point, Harold Hadrada is about 26. I just really want to kind of make that very clear.
He lives
clear.
A full life.
He sure did. So the escaping Vikings sneak into Maria's house and take her hostage before stealing two galleys and rowing out into the Golden Horn. But wait, you cry, isn't the Golden Horn cut off from the rest of the Straits of Bosphorus by a great chain that can be raised and lowered at will? Yes, I tell you, you have been listening.
Well done.
That is what they call setup and payoff.
Yes.
It was only set up 25 episodes ago.
Yes.
So the great chain is in their way, but Harold has a plan. He tells his men to run the galleys up against the chain until the prow of the boat breaches the water. And then they're supposed to run back and then run forward very, very, very fast so the boats will tip over and slide across the chain into the Golden Horn. This is the very, very Pirates of the Caribbean part of the story. I'm pretty sure this happens. So the first ship that tries it splits on the chain, sending a bunch of men into the water. But the second, carrying Harold and presumably Maria, levers its way over the chain and sails into the Bosphorus. And presumably, at this point, you can imagine Zoe running out onto a balcony and saying, no!
No! husband. He sailed away.
And then Constantine comes out like, honey, what are you talking about?
Don't worry about it.
So before sailing out, they drop Maria on the shore.
Sorry. Did I say husband? I meant house Carl.
So before sailing out, they drop Maria on the shore with an escort back to the city of presumably one of just a bemused Varangian. And according to Snorri, they told her to tell Zoe,
tell her relation, the Empress Zoe, how little power she had over Harold, and how little the Empress could have hindered him from taking the lady.
I could have had this lady if I wanted.
It's almost beat for beat that scene in the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Remember, this is the day you almost caught Harold Hardrada.
Yes!
Yes! Huzzah! So with that, the galley full of Vikings sails north back to Kiev. So on the road home, Snorri claims that Harold wrote the following verse.
Past Sicily's wide plains we flew, a dauntless, never-wearied crew. Our Viking steed rushed through the sea, as Viking-like fast sailed we. Never did I think along this shore did Norseman ever sail before. Yet to the Kievan queen I fear, my gold adorned, I am not dear.
So he gets welcomed back by Prince Yaroslav, who's like, whoa, that's presumably was like, that's crazy, man. And he overwinters in Kiev. And over that winter, he finally marries Elisif now that she is a teenager.
Yep.
It's not great. And so he returns to Scandinavia at 1045. He returns to Scandinavia in 1045, determined to take power back from his bastard brother Magnus. And so he meets with the king of Sweden and a claimant of the Danish throne that Magnus had defeated. And they combined forces and started raiding the Danish coast before heading north to target Norway. Now, Magnus hears about their coming and so agrees to meet them. And to avoid civil war, Magnus agrees to serve as co-king with Harald Hardrada. Now, if you've been listening and paying attention to this story, you'll understand that this is the point at which one of these people will die under not at all suspicious circumstances.
Yep.
And lo and behold, Magnus dies within a year, hashtag vaxxed, and Harald becomes sole king of Norway. By the way, I was saying to Joe the other day, I need somebody to make, like, a version of Jim Carroll's People Who Died. It's just a list of all the people who die in this story at the most politically convenient time under unspecified circumstances. So, Harald is now sole king of Norway. So he continues a lot of what Olaf had been doing. He continues to support the conversion of Norwegians to Christianity. He was, of course, a great patron of poetry and employed a multitude of court poets, who are a lot of our sources that Snorri is supposedly drawing on in the sagas. And he also
goes on, like, a lot of, like, excursions.
Yes.
He seems to really still have the taste for, like, adventuring, which I really like. So he apparently sails all over the sort of, like, north, and travels all over the north of the northern seas of Norway. It's been suggested that he went or tried to go to Finland. I think it's just, like, too fanciful, but
I mean, if anybody was gonna do it.
Yeah.
Imagine him just rocking up and be like, what up, Native Americans?
Huzzah! Let's go to America! Sir, what is America? I don't know.
You aren't ready for it, but your kids are gonna love it.
Yep.
And he also, the other thing that he never really gave up on was the idea of him being the man who will reconstruct Canute's empire. So when Hartha Canute had died, when Hartha Canute died, Magnus had inherited Denmark, but he had faced severe opposition within Denmark from a guy called, from Svein Forkbeard's grandson, who was also called Svein.
This is my son. He is also called Svein.
and Magnus had been sending quite prissy letters to Edward the Confessor saying, guys, this is mine. When Magnus dies, Svein the Younger leads a massive rebellion against Norwegian rule and forces Harald to recognize him as king of Denmark, which is, I think, technically the first real L in Harald Hardrada's career.
Yeah.
But he does continue to sort of ineffectually press his claim to be king of England based on a misinterpretation of a treaty between two men who are dead. And this doesn't really go anywhere until 1066, when a presumably incredibly embittered, vengeful Tostig Godwinson washes up in his royal court, and Snorri gives us the supposed dialogue that they had. He asked his aid to recover his dominions in England. The king replied that the Northmen had no great desire for a campaign in England and have English chiefs over them there. People say that the English are not to be trusted.
The Earl replied, "Is it true what I have heard people tell in England, that my relative, King Magnus, sent men to King Edward with the message that King Magnus had right to England, as well as to Denmark, and had got that heritage after Harthacnut, in consequence of a regular agreement?"
"How came it that he did not get it, if he had a right to it?"
"Hast thou not Denmark, as King Magnus, thy predecessor, had it?"
"The Danes have nothing to brag over us, Northmen, for many a place we have laid ashes to thy relations."
"If thou wilt not tell me, I will tell thee. Magnus subdued Denmark, because all the chiefs of the country helped him, and thou hast not done it, because all the people of the country were against thee. Therefore, also, King Magnus did not strive for England, because the nation would have Edward for king. Wilt thou take England now? I will bring the matter so far that most of the principal men in England shall be thy friends and assist thee, for nothing is wanting to place me at the side of my brother Harald but the king's name. All men allow that there never was such a warrior in the northern lands as thou art, and it appears to me extraordinary that thou hast been fighting for 15 years for Denmark, and wilt not take England that lies open to thee."
Yeah.
That was such a... That is... The fact that we have that exchange...
Yeah.
Is such a...
Even though it never happened.
It never happened.
Did you like my delivery?
I loved your delivery. It's very warm tongue. I mean, I think all I will say about this is that... It is a very... The saga of Harald Hardrada is very much an epic tragedy. And I've been referencing sort of Tostig Godwinson as a kind of Iago, as a kind of Erebus figure. The guy whose sort of spite and vengeance will take everybody down in this epic tragedy. And I think that is something that is very, that is something that Snorri Sturluson is very deliberately drawing on here, as he is so transparently manipulating Harald into this very, very big, very, very big gamble. And he is writing checks, remember, that Tostig absolutely cannot cash. He was chased out of Northumbria as Earl, and he's essentially been bouncing around Northern Europe as an exile, and now he's like, "I'll make sure that everybody in England, who all like me..."
Yeah. No, definitely. And I think it's all too easy to imagine after having this unbelievably glorious, like, enterprising start to his life, and then facing quite a bit of difficulty at home, and this just endless sort of drawn-out war for Denmark, that, you know, even a sort of hardened, wise ruler like Harald Hardrada would just need an easy win.
Yeah.
A theoretically easy win. And I mean, we talked in the last episode about all of the destabilizing factors on England and the idea that a country that had been in turmoil, you know, the mess that had been going on between the Godwin sons and Edward and the Normans and the Norse people, the idea that that could be a country... You know, that a country that has already, like, welcomed the stabilizing influence of one Viking king.
Yeah. The Viking king who he is specifically emulating.
Yeah.
And clearly has a bit of a chip on his shoulder about, given that it killed his sort of, his brother slash father figure.
Yeah.
But we will have to leave you there on that cliffhanger as Harald Hardrada decides to make his move against Harold Godwinson and the Kingdom of England. And we will rejoin you next time with the last of our kind of perspectives series, the final chapter, possibly the darkest chapter of these three, with the life and times of William the Bastard of Normandy. Well, that's just about going to do us for another episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. If you liked this episode, then please do leave us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. Tell a friend, make them listen to the extended Stavi's World bit, a reference to a podcast that you probably haven't listened to. But I promise you, if you listen to that show every week, that was hysterical. Isn't that right, Olivia?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, whatever.
Anyway, you can also leave us a Spotify comment, and if you do, Olivia might read one out.
Thanks to Anna, who said, "This is my favorite podcast ever, and I'll be happy to wait for a new episode for 10 more years. #realweirdo. Be careful what you wish for, Anna."
Yeah, that's why this episode was, in case you're wondering, that's why this episode was released in 2035. Go hunt that woman down.
Yeah.
If you want to kind of get amongst the Weird Medieval Guys universe, extended universe more, then you can join the official Weird Medieval Guys Discord, which, to be honest, great surprise, has continued to be quite active over our incredibly extended and poorly defined hiatus.
Yes, we love you guys. We'll drop a link to join in the description.
It's a lovely community of people who understand how to be normal on the internet.
It's so great. It's I love shocking. That we don't have to moderate it at all.
No. Oh, dear. But yes, no. Until next time, we will return with the Normans, which is going to be a more challenging episode in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You will learn that we are partisans, I think. In this story, and not necessarily in a way that reflects well on William the Conqueror. Until next time, take it easy.
Peace and love.